Good evening. Judge Amy Coney Barrett gets the kid glove treatment in the Senate as she refuses to say she'll recuse herself if the election goes to the Supreme Court. A statue of Abe Lincoln gets pulled down in Portland. Is it time to reevaluate the greatest president? And a memorial for a founder of Occupy Wall Street. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Tuesday, October 13th, 2020. The United States Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration to wind down counting for the 2020 census a month earlier than originally planned in a blow to civil rights groups that are concerned there'll be an undercount. The high court put on hold a lower court ruling that ordered the once-in-a-decade population count to continue until October 31st. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump on Tuesday asked the Supreme Court to freeze a lower court's ruling allowing Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. to enforce a subpoena for Trump's tax returns and other financial records for a criminal probe targeting the president. In July, the Supreme Court rejected Trump's argument he was immune from criminal probes as a sitting president. Vance's probe focuses on hush money payments Trump's former lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen paid to two porn stars who say they had sexual encounters with Trump. Recent court filings suggest the probe could focus on potential bank, tax, and insurance fraud, as well as falsification of business records. And on Capitol Hill, Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett insisting she would bring no personal agenda to the court, but would decide cases as they come, declined to say whether she would recuse herself from any election-related cases involving Trump, who nominated her to fill the seat of late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Trump is pushing to have Barrett confirmed before the November 3rd election. Excited by the prospect of a conservative judge aligned with the late Antonin Scalia, Trump's Republican allies are rushing ahead to install a 6-3 conservative court majority for years to come. But Rhode Island Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse says Barrett is a stalking horse for billionaire donors to dark money funds. They are aimed at environmental deregulation and political power.
There's this much dark money and this much influence being used. Here's how the Washington Post summed it up. This is a conservative activist behind-the-scenes campaign to remake the nation's courts, and it's a $250 million dark money operation. $250 million is a lot of money to spend if you're not getting anything for it. So that raises the question, what are they getting for it? Well, I showed the slide earlier on the Affordable Care Act and on Obergefell and on Roe versus Wade. That's where they lost. But with another judge, that could change. That's where the contest is. That's where the Republican Party platform tells us to look at how they want judges to rule, to reverse Roe, to reverse the Obamacare cases, and to reverse Obergefell and take away gay marriage. That is their stated objective and plan. Why not take them at their word? But there's another piece of it, and that is not what's ahead of us, but what's behind us. What's behind us is now 80 cases, Mr. Chairman, 80 cases under Chief Justice Roberts that have these characteristics. One, they were decided 5-4 by a bare majority. Two, the 5-4 majority was partisan in the sense that not one Democratic appointee joined the five. I refer to that group as the Roberts Five. It changes a little bit as with Justice Scalia's death, for instance, but there's been a steady Roberts Five that has delivered now 80 of these decisions. And the last characteristic of them is that there is an identifiable Republican donor interest in those cases. And in every single case, that donor interest won. It was an 80-0, 5-4 partisan rout, ransacking. And it's important to look at where those cases went, because they're not about big public issues like getting rid of the Affordable Care Act, undoing Roe versus Wade, and undoing same-sex marriage. They're about power. And if you look at those 80 decisions, they fall into four categories over and over and over again. One, unlimited and dark money in politics. Citizens United is the famous one, but it's continued since with McCutcheon, and we've got one coming up now. Always the five for unlimited money in politics, never protecting against dark money in politics, despite the fact that they said it was going to be transparent. And who wins when you allow unlimited dark money in politics? A very small group.
Rhode Island Senator, Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse. Whitehouse included the Federalist Society as a dark money conduit. The society's leader, Leonard Leo, has been described as Trump's subcontractor on the selection of Supreme Court justices. But Texas Republican Ted Cruz says the issue isn't dark money, but whether Democrats are trying to remove God from American society.
Ten Commandments case in the U.S. Supreme Court. There was more than a little bit of irony. And that, do you know how many times the image of the Ten Commandments appears in the courtroom of the Supreme Court? The answer to that is 43. There are two images of the Ten Commandments carved on the wooden doors as you walk out of the courtroom. You will soon be sitting looking at them. There are 40 images of the Ten Commandments on the bronze gates on the both sides of the courtroom. And then, Judge Barrett, when you're sitting at the bench, above your left shoulder will be a frieze you know well, a frieze carved into the wall of great lawgivers, one of whom is Moses. He is standing there holding the Ten Commandments, the text of which is legible in Hebrew as he looks down upon the justices, and four justices were willing to say, in effect, bring out the sandblasters because we must remove God from the public square. That is a profound threat to our religious liberty. And I would note that it doesn't just extend to public acknowledgments. It also extends to religious liberty.
And that's Ted Cruz earlier today. Minnesota Democrat Amy Klobuchar questioned Barrett closely on her commitment to Roe v. Wade, the decision that legalized abortion.
Is Roe a super precedent?
How would you define super precedent?
I thought someday I'd be sitting in that chair. I'm not. I'm up here, so I'm asking
okay,
you.
Okay, well, people use super precedent differently.
Okay.
The way that it's used in the scholarship and the way that I was using it in the article that you're reading from was to define cases that are so well settled that no political actors and no people seriously push for their overruling. And I'm answering a lot of questions about Roe, which I think indicates that Roe doesn't fall in that category. And scholars across the spectrum say that doesn't mean that Roe should be overruled, but descriptively it does mean that it's not a case that everyone has accepted and doesn't call for its overruling.
Here's what's interesting to me. You said that Brown is, and I know my time is running out, is a super precedent. That's something the Supreme Court has not even said, but you have said that. So if you say that, why won't you say that about Roe v. Wade, a case that the court's controlling opinion in that Planned Parenthood v. Casey case has described as a super precedent? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, Senator, I can just give you the same answer that I just did. I'm using a term in that article that is from the scholarly literature. It's actually one that was developed by scholars who are, you know, certainly not conservative scholars who take a more progressive approach to the Constitution. And again, you know, as Richard Fallon from Harvard said, Roe is not a super precedent because calls for its overruling have never ceased, but that doesn't mean that Roe should be overruled. It just means that it doesn't fall on the small handful of cases like Marbury versus Madison and Brown versus the board that no one questions anymore.
Minnesota Democrat Amy Klobuchar questioning Coney Barrett earlier today. Democrats stayed far from criticizing Barrett's conservative Catholic faith, but a former Catholic priest and author, Matthew Fox, says being a Catholic doesn't mean forcing your views on others.
People prefer the word spirituality to religion because religion has made many, many, many mistakes over the centuries. And including endorsing slavery. Hopefully we've learned some things over the centuries. Yet religion can play a very positive role. Spirituality is really the heart of religion. And it is about trying to live a life with integrity and depth and not superficially. Thomas Aquinas says the essence of religion is supreme thankfulness and gratitude. And Thomas Aquinas, one of the great doctors of the church, and Italian like yourself. And you notice in that definition of religion, it doesn't even mention buildings and rules and laws. It is a virtue, says Aquinas, a virtue of gratitude, supreme thankfulness, he says. It's about living life with a sense of passion and a sense of sharing and of gratitude. That often gets missed because religion sometimes becomes an object in itself. And like any other object that humans give birth to, it can develop a very big ego. And it's all about itself and not about service and celebration and gratitude.
Former Catholic priest and author Matthew Fox, law professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former head of the National Lawyers Guild, is Marjorie Cohen. She says Democrats focus their questions on Barrett's views on Obamacare, both to avoid religion and to illustrate the threat to millions who would become uninsured if the health care measure was overturned by the court.
When Senator Leahy asked her how many people are covered under the Affordable Care Act, she said she didn't know. Everybody knows that. It's been in the news reports. Senators have been mentioning it right and left. She doesn't know how many people have a Medicaid expansion. She doesn't know how many kids under 26 are covered by their parents' policies. And most significantly, she doesn't know how many Americans have tested positive for the coronavirus. It's 7.7 million. She is playing dumb. And then she was confronted with Trump's statements that the election might be decided by the Supreme Court. We have to have nine justices on the court. That's why he's rushing to get her on the court, basically so she can vote to uphold his victory, even if he is not victorious. But if there is a Bush v. Gore situation again, where the Supreme Court is called upon to decide who's the winner, if Trump contests a Biden victory, several senators have asked her to commit to recusing herself, in other words, not participating in a case that comes to the Supreme Court that has to do with who wins the election, basically. She would not commit to that. She was asked about super precedent, not just regular precedent of the Supreme Court, but precedent that is really important precedent. She said that Brown versus Board of Education super precedent. She said that Roe v. Wade is not. That leads me to believe that she would readily vote to overrule Roe v. Wade. She said the reason it's not super precedent is because people have questioned it, questioned the result since Roe v. Wade was decided, whereas people haven't questioned Brown versus Board of Education. I think she's probably wrong about that. Maybe the racists that are coming out of the woodwork under the Trump administration haven't been explicit about overruling Brown, but I'm sure many of them would like to. But in Congress, people have talked about the Affordable Care Act. In fact, 70 times Congress has, the Republicans in Congress have tried to overturn Obamacare and take health insurance away from tens of millions of people, including pre-existing conditions.
Where does religion come into this?
She has said that she subscribes to Justice Scalia's philosophy. She agrees with him, not on everything. She said she doesn't agree with him on everything, but she really is in the mold of Scalia, which is the kind of justice that Trump promised to appoint. Senator Whitehouse talked about the dark money behind her nomination and said that there was $250 million in dark money. That means secret money. We don't know where it comes from. And also right-wing organizations writing amicus briefs for senators that would overturn the Affordable Care Act and also get her on the bench. And the Federalist Society is one of the big organizations behind it. He said there are 80 cases that were decided 5-4 with no Democrats in the majority. Identifiable GOP donor interests basically led to a win in all of them, every single one of them. And he said they're not about Roe v. Wade or the Affordable Care Act. They're about power. And he identified first unlimited dark money in politics. Second, knocking down the civil jury so that corporations would not have to pay out large sums of money in litigation, and weakening regulatory industries such as polluters. We're not just talking about Roe v. Wade and the Affordable Care Act. The Democrats have been very careful not to attack her religion, not to bring up the People of Praise cult that she's a member of, but everything that she has written as both an academic, as a citizen on the bench, points toward her fulfilling the right-wing agenda on upholding any kind of religious attack on the rights of LGBTQ people. For example, she said, oh, she abhors discrimination, but she refused to say she opposed discrimination against LGBTQ people.
What about so-called packing the court, expanding the Supreme Court?
There's nothing in the Constitution about nine justices. It's no magical number. And it has been more or less over the years, although it's been nine for probably 100, 150 years by now. Franklin Delano Roosevelt tried to increase the number of justices because a 5-4 majority of the Supreme Court was overturning his New Deal legislation. But at the last minute, Justice Roberts, probably no relation to Chief Justice Roberts, went along with the liberals to uphold some of the New Deal legislation. And so the court packing kind of fell by the wayside. Joe Biden has not committed to, in fact, he's opposed court packing in the past. He refuses to say how he feels about it now. They could increase the number of justices on the Supreme Court to, say, 13, for example. A lot of things are up in the air, the election most immediately, but then Affordable Care Act, and it's very frightening what could happen.
And that's Marjorie Cohen. She's the law professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former head of the National Lawyers Guild. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Protesters in Portland, Oregon, swept through the city on Sunday night, toppling statues of Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt in a demonstration against colonization and the treatment of Native Americans. The action was a protest or billed as part of a protest known as Indigenous People's Day of Rage. Portland police arrested Brandon Bartellis, 38, of Pasco, Washington, after identifying him as a driver of the van used to bring down the Roosevelt statue. Bartels was also arrested at a protest in Kenosha, Wisconsin in August. Back then, he was accused of violating the curfew that was in place after a protest erupted following the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Elizabeth Mitchell is author of a book about Lincoln. It's called Lincoln's Lie. She was formerly the executive editor of George Magazine. And Mitchell says Lincoln was, although a great president, had his faults, including leaking information to the media to obscure his plans and also putting people in prison without trial and ordering and giving the final approval to the largest mass hanging in American history, that of 38 Native American prisoners. She spoke with WBAI earlier today.
No question that if there hadn't been someone who decided to push the moral compass of the United States to abolish the horror of slavery, then we would have been worthless as a country. You have to give him all sorts of credit for taking that courageous stance, which he knew was possibly would end his life. And he also had to weather all of the horror that unfolded in the country as that war was fought. But he's not perfect. And I think that one of the things that's almost reassuring is that when you read the history, you realize we are not the worst. There were all sorts of problems within his presidency about free speech. Certainly his abolishing habeas corpus, the right to a free trial, is a problem. And then what's been highlighted in terms of his stance about Native Americans, no one's perfect.
Your book is about a specific circumstance, about freedom of speech, about a newspaper, and about a lie that he told.
My book is called Lincoln's Lie, and it's a true Civil War caper through fake news, Wall Street, and the White House. In 1864, a fake news story ran. It was a proclamation from the president announcing that the country was in terrible shape in terms of the war and that he needed 400,000 men immediately to report to the front. It set off stock market craziness. People were gathering in the streets. He went into the biggest rage anyone had seen him in the entire presidency. He sent the military into the newspaper offices and arrested the editors and put military in two different newspapers for several days. He also shut down the Telegraph, which was their internet. Then as you go through the story and you start to look at the twists and turns of who gets arrested and where the investigation goes, it turns out there's a whole lot more to the story. And in fact, Lincoln may have been covering up what was real news.
And what was the real news?
He had signed that very same day an order for 300,000 men, and he wrote it out by hand, signed it, and put it in his desk drawer. It was dated the exact same day, so it's essentially a leak of that information.
He might have been himself leaking his own news.
Yes, or someone very close to him.
If he had Twitter, would he have been on Twitter?
Lincoln had this access to the Telegraph, and he would send out messages directly. The press had to just print them at verbatim. And they were saying it's dangerous because he has this communication with the people that's like lightning. It was his Twitter, and he slept at the Telegraph office in the War Department, and he read every message that he could, whether it was meant for him or not. Lincoln's motivations were not necessarily for his efforts to corral power or for his ego. And that's a huge difference.
He ordered execution of 38 Native Americans who were just trying to get their land back and set in motion a dominoes that led to Little Bighorn.
Mm-hmm.
That taken away from the picture just for now, what does that tell us about Lincoln?
For him to stand up against something that was so institutionalized in terms of slavery and so at the core of the profit making in this country was a massive moral stance. Maybe it's better to think of the whole country as a whole as being heroic as opposed to one individual. In the story that I tell in this book, there were heroes popping up all over the place to challenge Lincoln.
Should the statues stand?
If you look at those particular incidents with Lincoln coming down and Roosevelt, first of all, it was one man who donated those statues to the city. There was no oversight. Community didn't come together to choose those particular statues. There's something very good about the fact that we're talking about Lincoln's legacy and all its complexity, because I think we should understand our fellow citizens to understand what is the upsets and sadness that's at the core of all of this struggle. It would be nice if the statues that go up in the future really are an expression of what the community chooses. The discussion is much part of the honoring as the actual monument.
And that is Elitha Mitchell. She's the author of Lincoln's Lie. She was the executive editor of George Magazine. In a little known aspect of Lincoln's presidency, the army executed 38 Native American prisoners by hanging on December 26, 1862 in Mankato, Minnesota. It remains the largest mass execution in American history. The U.S. Army originally wanted 303 Lakota natives hanged for a rebellion called the Dakota War. Lincoln approved the execution of the 38. And last month, a founder of Occupy Wall Street died. Occupy is the movement that occupied Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan for 2 months and sparked a worldwide anti-capitalist movement. On Sunday, dozens of Occupy veterans met at Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan to memorialize Graeber. And of course, that was David Graeber, and he was the American anthropologist and anarchist activist known for several books on debt, utopia, and as an anthropologist studied how Native cultures could be used to inform people who wanted to form a new anti-capitalist society. Marissa Holmes is a friend of David Graeber and described his importance to the movement.
David is remembered for the We Are the 99% slogan, but really that, you know, only focuses on the discursive level of what Occupy was about, on the representation of it. And, you know, really what Occupy was about was the experience of being together in this social space, of engaging in this directly democratic process, self-organization. You know, and this is what David was really about, you know, more than the 99%, was this engagement, you know, with one another, you know, building new worlds. How do we bring in this, like, you know, everyday practice of revolution? And it's a question that, you know, we continue to ask because it's an ongoing process. You know, we have to try as hard as we can to get to this sort of horizon, this ideal, you know, and obviously we don't always get there. Often we fail in many ways, but it's still worth the trying of it, you know?
Do you see, like, echoes of Occupy and the stuff that's been happening this summer?
Over the summer, we saw a number of occupations of public space, of, you know, people asserting their own claim to some kind of autonomy, right? Like, without the police, the no-cop zone idea is basically an autonomous zone. And that's definitely in line with what we were doing in Occupy Wall Street, only in different language and in different context, but the practice is very similar. And that's really what matters, you know, is the practice. You know, David was very adamant about the small a anarchism, you know, so more than the ideology or, you know, calling yourself an anarchist, it was doing the thing, you know, in the world.
Marissa Holmes says, although Graber died too soon, to the best of her knowledge, it was a natural and not suspicious death.
I was shocked when David died. I didn't know of any underlying health conditions. No one did. I mean, I was in touch with him over the summer, and he said that he was sick and basically had kind of a head cold. He was concerned he had the coronavirus, but he was tested multiple times in the UK. They do house visits there, and he always tested negative. So it's very unlikely that that's, you know, the cause. Also, his symptoms later didn't really match up with typical symptoms of the coronavirus. And what happened in Venice, I mean, it was very sudden. He was, you know, whisked away to the hospital, having stomach pains, really intense, like sharp pains. And then they realized after he was admitted that he had this internal bleeding. After the autopsy came out, it was clear that the bleeding was really isolated in the pancreas and then spread to the rest of the body. So it was a form of acute pancreatitis. Now, what caused that is still kind of a mystery. It seems, you know, it was all natural causes. No, there weren't any other substances or any, you know, nothing showed up in the report. So he wasn't poisoned or anything like that. There was no malicious intent. But the exact underlying cause is still unknown.
Activist Marissa Holmes. David Graber was living in Venice, Italy, where he died. He was 59. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, October 13th, 2020. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson from New York City. I'm Paul D'Arienzo for the WBAI News. Thanks for listening.